Hi, everybody. I'm Chris. I'm an alcoholic. And I'm still full. Happy Thanksgiving, everybody. I would like to thank Larry and Damian for asking me to come down here with you tonight and share my experience. It's always an honor and a privilege to be part of Alcoholics Anonymous in some way, whatever that is. I want to say also, welcome to the new people of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's unfortunate we didn't have any chips tonight. And welcome to the visitors, and whoever was from Steamboat Springs, please see me after the meeting. I just want to see if you know a friend of mine. One of my best friends in Alcoholics Anonymous spent a lot of time sober in Steamboat Springs. So, and also Madison, thank you for your 10 minutes. That was I appreciate that. It's always nice to get a little meeting before you have to come up and do this, so thank you for that. And I want to recognize my wife, you guys. This is my beautiful wife, Michelle, who drove down with me today. Yeah, we celebrated 15 years of marriage this September, and that might not seem like a big deal to a lot of you guys, but, you know, I couldn't get more than 3 months in a relationship before Alcoholics Anonymous, so this is it's quite an accomplishment. And I want to say, Anthony from Akron, thank you for spending some time with us and sharing your story with us for the meeting. And Anthony's here from Akron doing night step work, and I think that's awesome. And I mean, that's the program in action right there, and so good luck with that. And I had to make an amends recently, and for the sake of keeping it real, I had to make an amends to my wife recently. She got really pissed off at me, and I have this theory, you know, I have a lot of theories, but I have this one theory about relationships, and that there's a circle in a relationship, and in healthy, functioning, equal type relationships, I think, you know, both partners occupy the circle at various times, right? The center of the relationship, and the unfortunate thing is being a self-centered alcoholic, you know, sometimes I camp out in the center of our relationship. and I did that recently, and I won't give you all the dirty details, but I had to clean that up. But thank you for Alcoholics Anonymous for that. That's how I think we've been married for, you know, 15 years now. And Al-Anon, actually, too. And I always like to share a story. I knew this was a serious relationship. When we came together in Phoenix, Arizona, I met Michelle in Phoenix, and I was, you know, active in AA, you know, and she's not one of us, so she was like, well, I better check this 12-step thing out if I'm going to be kind of getting serious with this guy. And so she started to go to Al-Anon and doing that regularly. And, you know, and I used to, you know, I had this thing going where I'd ask Michelle, could you do this or this or this for me? And, you know, it would typically get done. And one day I knew that things were changing in our relationship when I asked Michelle, would you do this or this or this for me? And from the other room I heard, you know, Chris, I'm going to give you the dignity to do that for yourself. And yes, dignity is overrated. But anyway, so... So I guess I should tell you. I want to tell you two stories before I tell you about my first drink. And the first one is just kind of these things that happened to me that kind of informed who I am as an alcoholic or who I think I am, you know, am as an alcoholic. And the first one is that I live in Huntington Beach, and I live a block away from the elementary school that I went to. And if you came over to my house, I could walk you over to that elementary school, and we could walk up onto the blacktop, and I could bring you to the exact spot where I had my first moment of clarity in the fourth grade. It was next to the handball courts, and I was at recess, and it looked kind of like this, actually. I was surveying the playground, and all the kids were out playing and doing what they do. And I was standing there, and I got hit with this realization, or the first experience, really, of not being comfortable in my own skin. And I still remember it clearly today. And that from that day to walking into Alcoholics Anonymous, that feeling never left me. And the second thing that happened to me is when I wrote my first inventory, I didn't think I was a really resentful guy. You know, so when I got to that piece, I didn't think there would be much on resentment inventory. I mean, the fear piece, I could really get behind that. I was afraid of my own shadow when I got here, but I didn't think I was all that resentful. But when I started to write, the first name that went on my list was my best friend, Richard, from when I was about 10 or 11 years old. And the reason Richard made the top of my resentment inventory was because one day he had called me up and said, "Chris, me and the pals are hanging out. Why don't you come over and hang out with us?" And I said, "Okay." And so I left my house, and I ran over to Richard's house, and I knocked on the door, and I listened, and I can hear him on the other side of the door, and they were laughing at me. And I was knocking on the door again, and I'm saying, hey guys, I'm here," knocking on the door, and they were just laughing on the other side of the door. And I knocked again, and they never ended up opening the door. And I walked home that day, and I said to myself that I'm never going to let that happen to me again. That I'm never going to let that happen to me again. And from that day till kind of well into it, and still struggle with it today, I kept everybody on the other side of that door. That's how I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. Not a great combination. Uncomfortable in my own skin and isolated. And so when I came up with my first drink, I think I'd like to say that I was ready for it. And how that happened, I was 13 years old. I was in the eighth grade. And some buddies of mine, they went home for lunch. And for some reason, I didn't go with them. I don't know why I didn't go with them, but I didn't go with them. And they went home for lunch. And they all got into a bottle of cream de menthe. And they came back to school, and one of them puked green all over his desk and ratted the rest of them out, and they all got suspended and in trouble and all that kind of stuff. And I walked home that day, and I said, "I'm going to have a drink." And, I didn't grow up in an alcoholic home like Madison. I didn't grow up in an alcoholic home. My grandparents were bad alcoholics. My mother's father was in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous, couldn't get sober in the 40s and 50s. And committed suicide on Christmas Eve when my mother was 19. And my father's father got about 10 years of sobriety in the 40s or 50s in AA, stopped going to meetings, drank again, and I only knew him drunk. And basically, he ended up dying from this thing. So so they grew up, and like my father, you know, went to 12 different schools before he even hit high school. It was that kind of life, you know. So he grew up in like really bad alcoholism. And so my parents weren't big drinkers, but in Bill's story, it talks about, you know, the warnings of his people. And I don't remember anybody explicitly saying anything to me, but there was this idea. I do have this kind of vague memory of, like, you know, I probably shouldn't drink. But that day, for some reason, I walked home and I said, I'm going to have a drink. And so I used to have no idea why that happened. And then I've kind of come to the realization that, you know, whenever I write fear inventory now, there's themes that come up, you know. They take different forms, but there's always kind of these themes in my fear inventory. And one of them, and so my biggest fears that show up in every inventory that I write are being embarrassed and being left behind. And for some reason, I think I probably went home that day and said, "My pals are starting to drink. I better learn how to do this." And so I went home that day. And like I said, my parents weren't big drinkers. And that little cabinet above the refrigerator, there was a couple of bottles of booze up there in case we, you know, had any visitors. And I knew there was a bottle of Smirnoff vodka up there. So I went home, and I was going to make me a screwdriver. And so I climbed up on that counter and got that bottle of Smirnoff. And my first drink was such a powerful experience. I still remember the color of the cup it came in. And it was this orangish Burger King, faded Burger King logo cup on it. And I set that thing down on the counter, and I filled it half full with vodka. I just thought what that's what you did. Filled it half full of vodka. And I was going to wait to the refrigerator for the orange juice, and there wasn't any orange juice, but there's old people in the room. You all remember Tang. Mom always had plenty of Tang available. So my first drink was a Tang screwdriver. It was a beautiful thing. But two really important things happened to me in that moment. And I know if you guys come to a speaker meeting regularly, you've heard it described, and I'm going to describe it the same way. And that is that when that alcohol hit my stomach and started to spread throughout, you know, the bloodstream, whatever it does, for the first time in my life, I knew how normal people felt. For the first time in my life. And the second important thing that happened that day is I made another drink. You know, I wasn't at a party. I wasn't trying to impress the pals or any girls. I was just there and made another drink and loved it. Loved it. And I was 13, and I didn't it's hard to drink every day when you're 13, but we tried to manage it. So I had a buddy, Bruce, who took up drinking about the same time I did. And he had an older sister who had an older brother who would buy us, you know, quarts of Old English and 12 packs, and we would split those, and Bruce and I would get a buzz on, and we would go pool hopping. I don't know if anybody went pool, you know. We'd go to the good neighborhood, and we'd swim in people's, sneak into people's backyards and swim into their pools. And punk rock hit my neighborhood that time. It was just like 79, pretty early, and I grew up in a neighborhood of a bunch of latchkey kids and misfits, and we had guys named Worm in our neighborhood and stuff, and so, and it was fun. We had a ton of fun, but the wreckage started early in my life. It was about I was about 16 when they kicked me out of high school, and my first moment of incomprehensible demoralization was when I got sat down in the truant officer's office, and my mom was there, and I didn't know, you know, I was didn't know she was going to be there, and I got sat down, and he showed my mother my attendance deal, and I hadn't been there in forever, you know, and that was the first look of incomprehensible demoralization I ever got. It was, still remember that moment. So then they figured, well, hey, you know, if you have a 3:30 start, they sent me to continuation school because it starts at 3:30 in the afternoon. They figured, well, maybe you can make a 3:30 start time, you know, and I couldn't do that, and so by the time I was 16, my educational career was over, and I was off and running. And I want to say that I've done it all right. You know, I've been to all the dark places. I've done the crash cars and the broken relationships, and I stood over my best friend as he went into an OD, and the best thing I could think of to do was to leave him there to die. And fortunately for me, he did not die. So I've been to all those places, but I want to share one particular bottom with you. And I couldn't tell you when, how old I was exactly when it happened, but in this bottom, I got a job at Wiener Schnitzel. I was living at Mom's. I was living at Mom's. I didn't have any wheels. And I got this job at Wiener Schnitzel. And I was in about day three of this job at Wiener Schnitzel, and you guys know the deal. Any money that's coming in, it's not going to food. So I got hungry about day three of this job, and I stole a corn dog, and they caught me, and they fired me. Thank you. Yes. And I did do the walk of shame in my brown polyester, walking home. And I remember that, too. It was a sunny Saturday, and I got hit with my next moment of clarity. And the day before I took my first drink, I was going to pitch for the Angels. I was going to be the next Nolan Ryan. I was going to throw heat. I was going to strike guys out to fame and applause. That's what I was going to do. And if that didn't happen, something equally important was going to happen in my life. You know, I knew I was destined to do something. But what happened that day when I was walking home from Wiener Schnitzel was I got hit with the first experience of nothing good's going to be happening in my life. Nothing good's going to be happening in my life. And the crazy thing is if you would have walked up to me that day and said, Chris, it's the booze, I would have looked at you and said, no, man, it's not the booze. It's this or it's that or it's this, but it's not the booze. Please don't take the booze. That's all that I had. And And I live that way. There's a guy in my home group that calls it dying an inch at a time. Alcoholics are dying. You know, some of us go out in a blaze of glory, you know, but some of us just die an inch at a time. And I'm one of those alcoholics that die an inch at a time. And I don't. I did that kind of living. You guys know the drill. You kind of bounce along these bottoms. You know, I like to say I was a sprinter in the game of life. I was always good for about 3 months, and then something would fall apart, you know, and I did that over and over and over again. And how it kind of ended for me was that, this is what happened. Some of you guys are going to recognize this. I had this job, and it was one of those great sales jobs where they would send me for the case of beer for the afternoon sales meeting, right? You know? So it was a great job for an alcoholic, but it was, you know. But it wasn't. So, but anyway, I had this job where I got paid on Thursday. I was broke on Sunday. And I'd go to work on Monday because I'm one of those alcoholics that shows up to work. And you do the on-the-job detox, you know. And then you hit your pals up for, hey, cigarette money or lunch money. I'll get you back on Thursday. You get paid on Thursday. Start it up and you're broke on Sunday. And you do it over and over again. And that's kind of just what I was doing. And what happened for me is that... Alcoholics Anonymous intervened, you know? No. And his name was Sean, and sorry, I'm a crier. Should have warned you. But his name was Sean, and he, and I'm still trying to find him. You know, my wife, actually, I was telling this story just the other day that, she's heard this story several times, you know, obviously many times, knew about Sean. And for a gift for me one time, she hired a private investigator to try and find him so I could say thank you. Because he was only there for 2 months, and I didn't know what was happening. You know, you just don't know what's happening. And but he came to work at the place I was working at, and he smoked, and I smoked at the time where we took these cigarette breaks together. And Sean would tell me about his life. Now I know he was just doing this beautiful 12-step job. He knew all about me. I know that now. He knew all about me. But never once did he, like, point a finger or talk to me about my drinking. All he did was tell me about his life. And in doing that, he had me doing this, nodding my head. And newcomer, if we have you nodding your head, you're in trouble. And so, you know, and eventually he let me in on the fact that he was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I had no idea about. I mean, I think we take that for granted. We think alcoholics are not. I mean, there's TV shows now, and there's all this kind of stuff. AA is everywhere. We think everybody knows what AA is, but I'm here to tell you, I mean, not everybody knows what AA is. There's people in AA for a long time that don't know what AA is, you know? But I did not know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous, but I did have this memory of a woman coming to a health class that I had. And I know now that she was with Public Information, and she shared her story, and she handed out the 20 questions. And I remember taking the 20 questions, and I answered like 17 of them yes, you know. And you know the drill, if you answer one, troubling, two, that's pretty bad. Three, you're screwed, right? And then, I answered like 17, but, you know, I wasn't married, so that one didn't count or all that kind of stuff. And I remember, like, saying, working for me, man. Working for me. Not a problem. But when he told me he was in AA, you know, I remembered her. There's a line in our book about people, like, just people whose deportment shouts that they have a real answer. You know, and I remembered her. And I remember maybe carrying the thought, if it ever did become trouble, there might be a place. And so, so one more time, I got paid on Thursday. I was broke on Monday. I came into work and I was, you know, doing the shake. And I hit that first cigarette break with Sean, and I said, Sean, would you take me to one of those meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous? That's how desperate I had gotten. And, of course, when somebody asked us for help, he lit up and he said, absolutely, Chris. He goes, can you stay sober for 24 hours? My home group meets tomorrow night, and we'll go to the meeting. We'll go to that meeting after work tomorrow. Can you stay sober? And I said, I think so. And I didn't drink at lunch that day. I went home that night, and it's a blackout. I still don't know what I did that night. I know I did not drink. I imagine that I probably walked around the neighborhood a lot, but I did not drink. And I went to work that day, and I made it all the way through work, and work ended, and Sean and I got in our cars, and we started to drive down the 405 freeway to the Make Yourself at Home group at Laguna Hills, my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm driving down the 405 south following Sean, and I have two thoughts. And the first thought is, I hope, beyond hope, they have an answer for me there. I had nothing left. I hope, beyond hope, they have an answer for me there. And the second thought was, I just made the worst mistake of my life. You know? I mean, isn't that really the drill, right? You know, it's like, blot out our intolerable condition as best we can, accept spiritual help. I mean, I think that we think maybe like that happens once. Like that, driving down the 405 freeway, that was my moment. Blot out my intolerable condition as best I can, accept spiritual help. I have come to understand that I do that daily. And sometimes I don't do it really well, right? But fortunately, I'm surrounded by people like you who know when I'm walking down the wrong path and are turning around. And I have friends that will stab you in the front. And newcomer, get those friends. Yeah. And the ones that will stab you in the front. And I'm very... It used to hurt. Now I'm really, really grateful for it. It doesn't hurt so much now. Now I know where it's coming from. And anyway, so I drive down the 405 freeway. I walk into my first meeting of AA. And it's in a hospital cafeteria. And the chairs are in a circle. I walk in. Everybody's greeting me like in a real nice way. Real nice people. And they start giving me a bunch of literature. And I don't know how they know I'm new. But now I know how that we know that you're new, you know. And... And so I sit down in my chair, and they did what you guys did tonight, and they did the chip thing, and they asked for newcomers, and Sean gives me an elbow, and I see that I'm to go up and get a chip, and so I walk up, and I get a chip and a hug. And I got to tell you, people, I come from German dirt farmers. We're not a hugging bunch. And so I always like to tell the story of if you ask my wife, we got married, I was 5 years sober when we got married, we had an AA wedding, we got married in our backyard, and it was a beautiful event, and it was a bunch of AA people, of course, and everybody was hugging, and they were, you know, hugging up on each other, and it was a really nice event. But if you ask my wife, after everybody left, what I talked about, she'll tell you that all I could talk about was that my father had hugged me that day. Because what had happened is that there was this AA example going on in the front of my house. I was standing in my driveway, and everybody was greeting me and hugging me. And my father walks up the driveway. This man has never hugged me before. Father walks up the driveway and gives me a hug on my wedding night. And I believe that's just one of those gifts of Alcoholics Anonymous. Just, they keep coming. They keep coming. And now we hug all the time. And I hug all the time. But so anyway, I get my chip, and I go down, and I sit down in my seat, and I look at my chip, and it says 24 hours, and I don't know about you, but I know about me. If you've been living a life like I was without any hope in it for a long time, and you get a little taste of hope, it's like a lightning bolt. And that's the way that it felt to me. I looked at that chip, it said 24 hours, and I hadn't felt it, that, and I couldn't tell you how long. And I started to, I want to share this. If I talk to the people who have experience with relapse in the room, and we sat to the side and I said, you know, when does your bell go off? I bet you could tell me. I have a friend, I've watched him for over 10 years come in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's about the six-month mark. Going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous without doing the do, you know, without working the steps, he's good for about 6 months. And then eventually the bell goes off, give or take, and he's got to go. And I've watched him do it for over 10 years. And I bet you guys, if I asked you, do you have experience with relapse, you could tell me, I'm a two-month guy, or I'm a six-month girl, or whatever. You all know when the bell's going to go off, right? And I think I'm about a 30- or 40-day guy. And the reason I share that is because I started to go to meetings every day. And I started to hear all the good stuff, and I was just... hearing stuff about get a sponsor, work the steps, pray, all that kind of stuff. And I was going to a lot of meetings, and I was meeting a lot of nice people, and I wasn't actually really doing any of that stuff, but I was going to a lot of meetings. And how I know that I'm about a 30 or 40 day guy is because it was on a Saturday night at the Rule 62 meeting in Sunset Beach. I went to that speaker meeting, and I went early. I made the mistake of going early. And I sat down in a row of chairs, or nobody was sitting there, and I sat there down by myself, and I started to think. Yeah. And what the thoughts that were coming to me was that I've been coming to AA now for about 40 days. I've been hearing really good stuff. But deep down where I live, nothing was changing, and if it didn't change soon, I was going to go take a drink. And I knew it. That's the truth. I knew it. And the crazy thing is I didn't want to leave. I didn't want to leave. And maybe that's why I have that's not a judgment to those people that have experience with relapses. It's not a judgment by any means. But I understand how it feels to be so close to the solution and not really be able to get it. And because I did not want to leave. And what happened to me is one more time, my higher power intervened, and it was one of these wise women of Alcoholics Anonymous sits down right next to me, and she said three things to me that changed my life, and I'm going to share them with you tonight because you might be able to say them to somebody else and change their life. And she sat down next to me, and she said, "How are you? How are you?" And for some reason, I don't know why, I got honest with her, and probably because she's a woman. For some reason, I got honest with her, and I just said, "I'm not doing so good. I'm not doing so good." And the next thing I know, she's not sitting next to me anymore. Some dude's sitting next to me now. And this guy... This guy starts to talk to me. I surf, he surfed, and we started to talk about surfing a little bit. And he started to ask me about me. And he said, "Chris, listen, tomorrow morning I'm going to go surfing, and then I'm going to go, there's a beach meeting down by where we live." And he goes, "And then I'm going to go to the beach meeting. Why don't you come and meet me? So we'll go surfing, and then we can go to the meeting after." And I said, "Okay." And I always say, there's a talk in AA about the 10,000-pound phone, right? I always call it my 10,000-pound surfboard because... I went home that night, and this is the crazy thing. I just had this moment of clarity. I'm sitting in this meeting going, that I don't know if I can stay here. And this guy offers me help, and I sit there that night and I debate, should I go meet that guy tomorrow? That's the crazy thing about this thing. Should I go meet that guy tomorrow? Blot out our intolerable condition as best we can, accept spiritual help. One more time, standing at the crossroad, right? The fork in the road. And fortunately for me, I got up that morning and I put the board on the top of the car and I drove down to the beach and I went to where he told me he was going to be, and I saw him out there, and I put on my wetsuit and I paddled out, and I saw him out there and I paddled out, and he turns around and he sees me and he's like surprised, because we're always surprised when you show up, newcomer. And he was surprised, and so we surfed for a little bit, and we talked, and we went to the beach meeting, and I asked him to sponsor me. And I didn't know what a sponsor was or what a sponsor does, but I knew that I needed one, and I asked him if he'd sponsor me. He said, "Of course." And fortunately for me, I think our higher powers just put people in our lives that are supposed to be in our lives, And I used to call him a big book thumper. But I don't do that anymore, really, because I don't think that's accurate. And the fact is that he knew the big book as well. I know that now. I had dinner with him on Tuesday night, and he knows the big book as well as anybody I know in AA. But he's also a very gentle man, and he was exactly what I needed. And he did something with me that I want to share with you, because it still guides me today. And we sat down and we started to, immediately he had me start reading the big book with him. And the first thing he had me do when we got together is he had me draw the circle and the triangle on my cover page. And he had me write Unity, Service, and Recovery. And he had me write the 12, what the 12 spiritual principles behind each, the 12 traditions, the 12 steps, the 12 concepts. And he said, Chris, this is your compass. He said, if you can get in all three parts of the program, you can be whole again. And that's the promise of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said, if you feel out of sorts, go back to your compass. What aren't you doing in AA? And from that, and that's what I do with my guys I work with now. And it's from this that day to this, it has served me well. And I forgot to tell you, my sobriety date was April 26, 1993. That's when I went to my first meeting. And April's a good month, Madison. So hang on to that day. But anyway, so I got 10 minutes left, so I'm going to tell you a couple stories. He took me through the work. He took me through the rest of the book, and you know, the obsession to drink didn't leave me right away. I'm one of those guys too. But what happened to me, and I don't even couldn't even tell you what step had happened to me. But as soon as he put me into that big book, and we started to read it together, I had a moment where I was doing something, and I realized I hadn't thought about drinking that day. And I believe that, from my own experience, is the direct result of taking the, you know, it wasn't that I just finished my fifth step or I completed my nine-step amends or anything like that. It was the act of submitting myself to the process with this sponsor that began to make everything change for me. And he took me through that book, and when it asked the question, I answered it. And when it told me to do something, I did it, and through that process, my life changed. And the stories I want to tell you, and he was actually an active member of H&I. He started taking me to jails and prisons and hospitals, and we were all over the place. He still is an active member of H&I. And we were going everywhere. And but what happened is when I was 2 years sober, I moved to Arizona. And I changed jobs. I got a new job, and I rapidly climbed up this job because I was sober. And they asked me if I'd go to Arizona for them, and I did because I'd never been to college, away to college. I think everybody had a college experience. I'd never left Huntington Beach, you know. You know, we have small worlds in alcoholism, right? And so I said, yeah, I want to see the world, Arizona. That was a big leap for me, you know. And so I go to Arizona, and I don't know anybody in Arizona, but I know AA's there. So I go to Arizona, and the first thing I do when I get there is I go to East Valley Intergroup, H&I Committee in Mesa, Arizona, and I walk into their meeting, And I come from Orange County, and our H&I committee is broken up into two meetings, and there's a ton of people, and everybody's active, and it's just a really active H&I group. But I walk into this group, and I was kind of shocked, quite honestly. There was like eight people sitting around a card table, and that was their H&I committee. And they were amazing people. All of them had multiple panels because of the demand, and there are not enough people like picking up the panels. And I walked out of that first H&I meeting as the chair of the institutions committee for H&I. And they'd known that I'd been to prisons and jails and taken meetings in, and they said, it's your job now. And so, and it was a wonderful experience. But what I want to share with you is that I got a call one day. You know, we were starting meetings, and I got a call one day from a social worker up on the reservation. And she said, Chris, there was a jail on the reservation, and everybody in that jail, 99.9% of the people, that the offenses were behind alcohol. And she said, we really need a meeting here. Can you come take a meeting? I said, yes, absolutely. And so we started going up there, and I was going up there, and I was doing a meeting. You know the drill. It's a gray cinder block room. They shuffle the guys in the orange jumpsuits in, and we have our meeting. And I'm doing that and reading the readings, sharing our experience, bringing a friend or two with me. Sharing our experience, strength, and hope. We open up the meeting for people to share, and they all stare at us, and not a word. And then we leave, and then we come back in the following week, and we do it all again, and we open it up to share, and not a word. And we did this for a couple of months. And one particular Wednesday, I'm going up there, and I'm going up there, and I'm saying, you know, we're going to get it. We're going to get up there. And I got to tell you, actually, what I need to tell you is there was this guy that would always come, and he would sit at the back. And he was 6'6". He had a bald head. He was a Pima Indian, and his name was Riley. And he was a scary-looking cat. And whenever we opened up the meeting, people would look to him for, like, permission, you know. And he would be all stone-faced, mad-dogging us, you know. And so, but we were going up. I was probably 2 months into this panel, and I'm thinking we're not getting anywhere. And I go in to the room, and I'm thinking I'm going to be out of here in 20 minutes. We're going to do our readings. I'm going to share a little experience, strength, and hope, and then open it up, and nothing's going to happen. And so I do that, and I open it up, and I'm waiting for, you know, the crickets. And I see Riley from the back raise his hand. And he says, yeah, I'd like to share. And you're like, whoa. Go ahead. And Riley tells us that he says, my grandmother told me that if I have a bad dream, I should share it so that it doesn't come true. And he begins to tell us a story about how last night, the previous night he had a dream where there was a canal that ran through the reservation, and he had taken his family to a picnic there, and they were having a really good time, and he was with his two kids and his wife, and they were having a good time. And then he said that a bull started to come into their little picnic site. And Riley decided that he was going to get on the bull and try and ride it. And so he gets on the bull, and he says how he got ties down to the bull. And he said the bull started to get really, really angry and do its huffing and puffing, what bulls do, and trying to buck him off. And then it starts going after his kids. And Riley was telling us how he was kind of screaming in the dream, and he couldn't get off the bull. And then the bull started going after his wife, and he was screaming, and he couldn't get off the bull. And then he stops, and he says, I think that bull was alcohol. And I know. And I used to hate the desert. I'm a beach guy, right? And so I need to be around water. But I walked out of that jail that day, and I was standing on the black asphalt of the parking lot, and there was a desert sunset. And I tell you, they're really beautiful. But I was struck with the experience of that I was no longer that kid in fourth grade. That it had changed. And I also, because of people like Riley and people like you, I wanted to be connected again. I wanted to open the door. When I made amends to my mother, she told me two things. The first thing was, she said, Chris, I used to pray for you, and then I stopped praying for you, and I started to pray for the people around you. And that's where I took my mother. And but I also, she also told me a story about my grandmother. And my grandmother was married to my mother's father, who committed suicide on Christmas Eve when she was 19. And he was in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous and couldn't get sober. But my grandmother had experience with AA. And so my mother told me the story that when I made amends to her, that when she found out I was going to Alcoholics Anonymous, she called my grandmother and she said, Chris is going to AA. And what do you think? And my grandmother's, like I said, had experience with AA. And her experience with AA was that in Tecumseh, Nebraska, a small town in Nebraska, that whenever she called AA, they came. Whenever she called AA, they came. They never quit on my grandfather. My grandfather never got sober. It was probably a pain in the ass, actually. Never got sober, but my grandmother's experience of AA was that when she called, they came. And she told my mother that if he's with AA, he's going to be okay. If he's with the people in AA, he's going to be okay. And the amazing thing about that is that, think about it, 30 or 40 years after that event, you know, the actions of the men of Alcoholics Anonymous, when I was coming into AA, gave comfort to my family. The actions of these men 30 or 40 years previous gave comfort to my family. And that's a debt that I have to pay here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's why I'm going to keep coming back. Thanks.